Welcome to the workshop today. My name is Daryl Hurst, and I serve as the senior pastor of Dove Westgate Church. And the title of this workshop is Sharpen Your Leadership Skills. And as I start out, I want to take just a few minutes to talk to you about excellence, pursuing excellence in your leadership. First, let me just say that pursuing excellence honors God, and I believe that it inspires people. I love a story that I heard years ago from Bill Hybels. Bill, of course, had a bit of a fall from grace, as you may know, but I still like to use his example, and I actually get a lot of good leadership things still from Bill's material from years ago. But Bill tells a story from many years ago, and the experience about excellence that drove this point home with him. Bill had a speaking engagement in Dallas, Texas, and he late one evening before his speaking engagement, he was in his hotel room. He was kind of mindlessly flipping through the TV channels, and he happened to stop on ESPN for a minute or two, and he saw that earlier that day, Martina Navratilova had won a grueling tennis match in Florida. Now, some of you may not even know who Martina Navratilova is, especially you youngsters sitting here. But Martina, she's now 68 years old. But Martina was arguably the best female athlete of all time. She was a tennis player. She won 18 Grand Slams. Some people might argue for others like Serena Williams or Steffi Graf. But whatever the case may be, Martina was one of the greatest. So he saw this. Next day, Bill gets up at 5:30 a.m. He goes down to the hotel's gym, but he wasn't the only person there. He saw a woman coming through the glass doors. It was Martina Navratilova. She had been in Florida the day before playing a grueling tennis match, but now she was in Dallas for whatever engagement she had there. But she was up at the crack of dawn, eager to hit balls back and forth as if she had nothing better to do, like sleep, maybe. And I'm sure no one had to tell her that she had to be up doing this. She crawled out of bed before the sun even came up, and she headed to the gym because of her insatiable desire for excellence. She wanted to win that badly. And I believe that leaders at every level possess an internal quality control mechanism that won't allow them to slouch. It compels them to achieve higher levels of efficiency and of effectiveness than anyone else could ever hold them accountable to be or to do. It's very powerful. Godly leaders don't need to be managed as much as they need to be unleashed, I believe. In Malachi chapter 1, Malachi is an interesting book because there's a lot of role play kind of going on for the purpose of illustrating a point. Malachi 1, God tells his people of an offense that he has against them. Of course, in Malachi 3, he talks about another offense he has against them, and that is that they weren't tithing and bringing their offerings. But in Malachi 1, he says, I have an offense against you. And the people say, what could you possibly have against us? What could have we done wrong? And God, speaking through the prophet Malachi, he says, what did you do? You know the laws about making sacrifices. You know you're supposed to go out into your herds and your flocks and find your prized animal, your best lamb, your best bull, and bring it as a sacrifice for me. But instead, what are you doing? You take a look at your flock, and you intentionally overlook the best sheep, and you look for the crippled one, the lame one, the blind one, and you bring that over to sacrifice me, the one that's lame, the one that can ready to keel over, that can barely walk. You grab that one and race to the altar to offer it unto me, God says. Malachi tells the people, here's what God says. Don't even bother building a fire. You're wasting your time. Because I don't want your sick. I don't want your blind. I don't want your lame lambs. I want your best lamb. Bring me your best lamb or bring me nothing at all. Now imagine the kind of stinging rebuke these people just received directly from God. I think this passage, to me, it gets my attention. It kind of crystallizes my focus on always giving my best service to God and to his church. Giving my very, very best. Everything I plan, every meeting I lead, every sermon I give, it needs to be my best lamb, my best offering. And so not so that I live under the tyranny of perfectionism. That's a different thing. And we're going to talk about that a little bit. There's the tyranny of perfectionism, and we don't want that, but we do want to live out of a deep, heartfelt desire to honor God with our very, very best. And so your very best is never going to be perfection, but it can be, as long as it's your very best, I believe that's what God's looking for. I have two passages of scripture I want to look at, and we'll look at these later. And then I'm going to get into some very practical ways that we can walk this out within the church setting. The two passages are from Colossians 3 and Mark 7, and we'll look at them in a bit. But I believe that we need to have a goal of living a life of excellence. And I want to show you from Scripture why you should be pursuing a course of excellence and explain what excellence is and what it is not. And I'm going to focus a lot on church work, but listen, I think it applies in every area of our lives. I think that we should keep our cars neat and clean. I don't care if it's 15 years old, but keep it neat and clean. Live a life of excellence. I think your clothing should be neat and clean. I think just it applies in every area of our life. Now, I want to talk a little bit about my own life personally. I grew up in a very rural setting, as Nelson knows very, very well. Very rural setting. And my father was always a blue-collared construction worker. My one grandfather was a stonemason. My other grandfather was a farmer. As a teenager, I worked on a neighbor's farm because where I lived, it was impossible to get a job at what you could get in town. So I just worked on the neighbor's farm. After graduation from high school, I got a job at a local kitchen cabinet manufacturing plant. While it was clear to me that my father and my grandfathers pursued excellence in their trades, there was no history or background in our family of white-collar business professionalism or anything like that. In fact, none of my parents or grandparents had ever even graduated from high school. You didn't do that back then. You got to the end of eighth grade, you knew how to write, you knew how to read, and that's all you needed. So now it's time to get out there and do some real work. That was the mentality back then. So from that background, at the encouragement of a relative, I decided to become, by the way, I did graduate from high school, but at the encouragement of a relative, I decided to get into real estate sales, become a real estate sales professional. Looking back, it's probable that my lack of understanding and my lack of experience in the professional world may have been one of my greatest advantages, because I came into the business world with the mindset that I had no idea what I was doing. I had no idea how to do any of this. But I was committed to, but I did know that the guys that I was going to work alongside of did know. And I was determined to do whatever they told me to do, whether agree with my personal philosophy or not. I mean, I was just going to, as long as it didn't stray into moral problems, you know, I'm just talking about business philosophy. I was going to do whatever they told me to do because I knew I didn't know what to do and I knew that they did. Well, one of the first things that they taught me was to dress for success. We even had a speaker come in to one of our sales meetings and teach us how to dress for success. Well, at that time, I didn't own even a single suit, but some local store was running a buy one, get one free suit. So I went out and bought two suits, a blue one and a gray one, as you might imagine, and complete with a white shirt and a red tie. And now I was ready for business. I was ready to go. I was the best dressed looking farm boy in town. The next thing they taught me was punctuality and dependability. Every phone call must be returned the same day, preferably in less than 2 hours. My car had to be spotless. It did not have to be expensive, which was a good thing because I had no money. And I had a 1978 Ford Fiesta without air conditioning and with crank-up windows. That's what I started out in real estate with. So I had no money. I had a very meager car. But it just had to be spotless inside and out. Listen, the list could go on. I could make a much longer list. But they taught me point by point principles of excellence. They taught me how to conduct all of my affairs with excellence. And since those early days, that one guiding principle has stayed with me, the principle of excellence. Later, when I left the business world and became executive pastor under our former senior pastor, Dwayne Britton, I saw that he too sought to do everything with excellence. And I quickly saw that this principle is even more important, I believe, in the church world than it was in the business world. And I see two reasons why it's more important. Number one is souls. The business of the church is about the souls of people. It's one thing to pursue excellence in business, and I believe that we should, but in the church, as we expand the kingdom in people's lives, as we save people from the brink of the precipice of eternal destruction that awaits them, excellence, proficiency, efficiency, expediency, they're all paramount. Number two is history. Historically, at least in my history, lackluster presentations, shabby buildings, poor presentation, minimal commitment have been considered business as usual for many churches. Acquiescent acceptance of these mindset is not the path to engaging pre-Christians, nor does it inspire those already in the church. So I would encourage everyone in all of our various ministries to operate from a place of excellence because it communicates that you value what you're doing. Of course, this principle doesn't apply just to the church. It can be applied to any area of your lives. I think the more we use it, the more we live it, the more we'll love it and learn to live that way. But let's talk about excellence in the church a little bit, since this is, in fact, a church sermon conference we're in. How would you feel if I walked in here today and I said something like this? You know, I feel like this is a really important subject, but I feel kind of bad. I have to tell you that I'm sorry. I'm not really very ready for this workshop today. You see, trout fishing just opened in Pennsylvania, and I've been busy fishing, and it's been good fishing. And so we're just going to wing it today. We'll see what the Holy Spirit has to say. I mean, we all love each other, right? You know, this is the body of Christ, and let's just see what God does with this. Is that okay? And that's not the case. But how would you feel if I came in here and said something like that? You'd feel dishonored. You'd feel disrespected. You'd feel like, why did I waste my time coming into this? Now, is that, you'd feel very, very devalued, I think, by a statement like that. Now, is that a far-fetched example? Not as far-fetched as you might think, based on some of my experiences in the church setting. I've been in small group meetings where the small group leader said pretty much those words. Well, I didn't get a chance to prepare anything. Let's just whatever, you know. And that's not good. Have you ever sat in a church service where the service started 5 or 10 or 15 minutes late? What does that communicate? Have you ever been in a service where they announced that a video was about to play and nothing happened? We all have. Every hand can go up for that one. So that's not to be to say that if you do everything right, that'll never happen. We're operating with electronic gadgetry that has its own mind sometimes. We just had that happen about, I don't know, 2, 3, 4 months ago at Westgate. But it wasn't because we didn't practice and play it ahead of time and make sure it worked. It's because the computer decided to lock up. Have you ever seen a bulletin full of typos? Have you ever heard the ramblings of an obviously unprepared preacher? I sure have. And I can tell in a minute when a guy comes in and he's unprepared and he's just winging it as he goes. Slipshod and disorganized services happen with an alarming frequency from my perspective. So today I have 7 points on excellence. Later we'll talk about contrasting excellence with perfectionism. And we don't want to fall into perfectionism. But let's start out by looking at our ultimate role model. That, of course, is Jesus Christ himself. Mark chapter 7, verse 37. People were overwhelmed with amazement. He has done everything well, they said. The New King James says it this way. They were astonished beyond measure. Why were the people overwhelmed with amazement and astonished beyond measure? Because the default position of most human beings is to try to get away with the least possible level of commitment. What's the minimum level of effort I can put out and get away with it here? But Jesus did everything well. And guess what? It inspired and it captivated the people. Which leads me to point number 1 of my 7 points. Excellence is attractive. Excellence is attractive. How many of you make an effort to clean up your home or fix a special meal when company, when guests are coming over? Of course you do. And some of you might even do more than that. You might even keep a room in your house especially neat just in case someone drops by unexpectedly. Back when I grew up, back in the old days, a lot of the old farmhouses had a parlor. The parlor was a room never to be used except when guests came over, right? because we had to have just that perfect room. The kids could never play in it, whatever. But the point is, you have an expectation of having something excellent to present to your guests. And you try to have a beautiful or a nice meal for them. Others, by the way, might demonstrate the excellence on their job. My dad is like that. For the first 25 years of his career in the trades industries, he was a plasterer. Now, that's a dying or a dead occupation. Nobody plasters anymore. It got replaced by drywalling. But I had the opportunity to help him. I'm old enough that I had the opportunity to help him as a teenager a few times, helping to plaster walls. My role was to mix the mud. Mud is a term for the stuff that you put on the wall. My job was to mix the mud and carry it to the mud board, and they would apply it to the wall. I often stood in utter amazement as they would take this mud. They'd put it on a thing called a hawk. You put the mud on, you take a trowel, and you put it on the wall. If you saw someone doing that today, that's an excellent at it, you would be amazed. They put it on the wall uniformly, perfectly. And then they'd take a straight edge, and they'd take the straight edge, and they'd run along the wall and just make sure everything was just perfect. And then that had to dry over a period of a couple weeks. And then they put the final coat on of lime. And that lime going on the wall, that was a much thinner coat, about an eighth of an inch thick. And they'd trowel that on, and then they'd take a brush with water and brush it. And they'd work that until it was smooth as glass. It just had to be perfect. Guests would walk in, or the contractor would walk in, a customer would walk in, and they'd look at it in amazement, like, how did they do that? It's perfect. And to present anything to the customer that was less than 100% perfect was not even in his realm of imagination. They'd stand back and they'd look at the wall and look at it a couple different ways. And if they saw something that wasn't just perfect, they'd go back and rework that area. It had to be perfect. If that is true on those construction sites, why not in church? Aren't we expecting guests? We want them to experience our commitment to God in a tangible way. And one way for us to provide is for us to provide a service that is well prepared, well thought out, prepared and presented with excellence. We need to start on time. The sermon needs to be thoughtfully written and competently delivered. The quality of the music needs to be high. The bulletin needs to be eye-catching and accurate. The building needs to be clean and attractive. The teachers and greeters need to be personable and welcoming. All of that tells our guests that we are serious about our faith and concerned about their welfare. It tells them we're not playing games. Our staff at Dove Westgate Church, we do a follow-up on all of our guests to see how things went. There's a way we could serve them better. Several years ago, on one such follow-up call, our staff person called them, and the guest commented, "We could see that you guys were serious about church." Touche. Indeed, we are serious about church, and I was blessed to see that they noticed. So, point number one is that excellence is attractive. Point number two is that excellence doesn't need to be extravagant. Excellence does not need to be extravagant. Don't confuse excellence with extravagance. While we don't want to look cheap, we don't have to spend tons of money. Excellence has more to do with being neat and thoughtful and prepared and punctual than it has to do with unnecessary frills. And generally, we can achieve excellence using things we can afford, which is good news for us here at Dove because we do not have an extravagant culture at Dove. That's not who we are. And I'm okay with that. That's cool. I actually like that. And by the way, some of the examples I use they're going to come out of my experience at Westgate. Your experience in your church might look a little different. So the way you approach things is a little different than the way I demonstrate it and some of the things I say, that's okay. I'm not saying our way we do it is the only way to do it. I'm just saying whatever you do, do it well and do it with excellence. Excellence means moving away from things that don't work. Oh, we're bad at this in the church. Often we keep doing things that are no longer effective, or we try to make something work that always seems to fail. Remember, the definition of insanity is to keep doing the same thing and expect a different result. That's insanity. If there was ever a place that we practice insanity best, it's in the church. We never want anything to change. I heard this axiom years ago. Some things are a problem to be solved. Others are a tension to be managed. And in my mind, this is clearly a tension to be managed. While there is something good and healthy and correct and proper about a church being rock solid in the middle of a culture of ever-changing values, we still must be ready to move away from things that simply don't work anymore. We have to have the intellectual integrity to acknowledge those things, and we must be able to change to maintain an excellence, a culture of excellence, by changing the way that things from things that don't work. This includes like all of our systems, our processes, our presentation, our facilities, our technology, even our terminology. But again, in the church, we don't like to change very quickly. This is how we've always done it, and we're not going to change. And so, but I think here's the thing. We're always going to have to be in the place of being willing to take risks. Because if you don't take risks in your personal life, you're never going to grow and develop. And we have to be willing to take a risk in the church world too. But we have to acknowledge it when something doesn't work. When we don't acknowledge failure, then we make ourselves look foolish. And when we beat a dead horse, we're not fooling anybody by continuing to do things that simply aren't working. Number four is excellence is in the details. Now, my wife, Mim, has helped plan numerous weddings over the years. I never cease to be amazed at the planning and preparation and attention to details that goes into the planning of a wedding. Every detail seems to rise to the level of importance that it needs to be run by the National Security Council before we finalize it. It's amazing. I've heard and seen lengthy discussions on things like the shade of purple that's going to be embossed on the napkins at the reception. And I'm not exaggerating. The length and the shape of the candles is the substance of dozens of emails and discussions and phone calls. The mind-numbing, for me, the mind-numbing details they go into could go on for hours. So why all the fussing over details that seem pointless to me? It's very, very simple. To this bride, and probably to her mother, there are few things in life more important than this wedding. And so their attention to details is a visible manifestation of how important this event is to them. Think about sporting events. Many positive things come out of sporting events, kids, particularly kids playing sports in high school, that sort of thing. However, at the end of the day, does anything of meaning in life really change based on whether some high school team wins or loses a certain game? No. Nothing earth-shattering is going to change the substance of the world really changes. Yet, we don't think anything about people practicing for hours and hours and hours. Coaches require the participants to be at practice every night after school. If you don't come to practice, you don't play. I mean, it's a big deal. You got to be there. You got to be prepared. What is the point of doing basketball teams? How many times do they practice free throws or layups or something like that? They do this because they take the game seriously. They're committed to doing their very best. Yet at the end of the day, not much really changes whether they win or lose. But what happens when it comes to church? Do we put enough effort into preparing the details of what we will say and practicing what we will present? One characteristic of healthy, engaging, and growing churches is the amount of time they spend preparing for the service itself. And now, I realize I'm going to use myself as an example. This is just my style. This is not everybody's style, and I totally get that. But it's very, very seldom that I do a message that hasn't been practiced at least twice. That way, when I'm doing it on Sunday morning, I'm going over stuff that I know really, really well. Beyond that, for me, it's part of the Bible says that faith comes from hearing and hearing the Word of God. So the first person the message gets preached to is me, and I get it in my spirit. There's times when I practice message, I get off the stage and I'm like, man, that was good. I can't wait to deliver. So it builds faith in me. but also it makes me much more prepared so that when I'm presenting that on a Sunday morning, it's something that's part of my spirit and I'm really ready to go with it. And so I feel like our worship team practices on Thursday night what we're going to do in worship. They practice again Sunday morning when they're doing it for real in front of the audience. Well, not for real. When they're doing it with a lot of people by the way, sometimes those worship practices are very, very worshipful. It's really powerful. And so when they're doing it in front of the audience, they're coming from a place that's just, it's part of their spirit at this point. Lighting, microphones, camera angles, you name it, it's always planned and practiced. And we have good people that could wing it and do well, but excellence requires more. There's always room to improve. Again, remember, excellence inspires people. Number five, here's a good one. Excellence should be judged by others. There's real difficulty trying to judge whether we're doing an excellent job or not. Think about this. Have you ever walked into a house where there's an obvious odor issue? I sold real estate for years. I can relate to this one. I walked into the house, I was like, man, get me out of this place. But you know, after you're there for a while, it wasn't not so bad after all. You know, the litter box that was atrocious when you walked in, I don't really even notice it that much anymore. Maybe they had fish for dinner that night. Smells kind of strong when you walk in. After you're there for a half an hour, I don't even really notice it anymore. This is how it is in church. We get used to certain things. That box full of whatever sitting in the hallway as you walk down to get into the children's ministry, as you walk to get into the auditorium, that box sitting full of stuff sitting there, it's been there for 8 months. I don't even see it anymore. Doesn't bother me. Well, others need to judge our excellence because newcomers see things that we don't even see anymore. It's an eyesore to them, things that we've become used to. So the first impression that we make on our guests is so critical. By the way, I talked about being welcoming, that our staff and volunteers are very welcoming. I went to a church one time when I was on sabbatical that I know to be a good church. It's in our area, and I know the leaders. I know the church. It's a good church. But I went there as a guest, walked in, into the lobby. No one greeted us. We came and sat down, sat through the service. After the service, I went in the back, and I on purpose walked around in their lobby in the back and looked at some of their bulletin boards and their mission board and just kind of hung out, you know, and did this and did that and waited to see what happened. Nobody engaged me once the whole time. And we walked out of there totally, never once were engaged. Okay, I know it's a good church, and the only reason I know it is because I know it. I don't know it because of what I experienced there. And so, again, there's a church that had some room to go grow in developing their people skills and embracing guests that show up at the church. His people didn't know who I was, but I was a spy is what I was. So I wasn't really a spy. Number six, excellence gets criticized. Now, this one could surprise you, but you would think if you do a superb job, that'd be welcome. Yet you'd be surprised how often others will criticize what is done to achieve excellence. There'll be those who say we're putting too much emphasis on externals. Churches are supposed to be about changing heart, focusing on lighting. That seems shallow. Building a nice cafe, that seems self-serving. And the list could go on and on. Over the years, we've heard this at Westgate. Bottom line is there will be differing opinions on what is a wise pursuit of excellence and what is just extravagance. You're going to have different opinions on that. So excellence will get criticized. Number seven, excellence is an attitude. So far, I've been talking about excellence in the terms of how it affects other people. But that, honestly, at the end of the day, isn't actually the main point. Listen to Peter's admonition. 1 Peter chapter 4 and verse 11, Peter says this. If anyone speaks, they should do so as one who speaks the very words of God. If anyone serves, they should do so with the strength that God provides, so that in all things God may be praised through Jesus Christ. To him be the glory and power forever and ever. The real reason for excellence is it's our attitude is that we're doing this as a service to God. Well, we want to reach others so that they will see what God has done in us, but we want them to see a glimpse of who God is and the depth of our commitment to him. And so the real audience for our service is God himself. Our service is our gift to God. God gave us his very best, his son, his one and only son. He deserves nothing less than best from us. Dove is an apostolic movement with forward momentum. we must be growing and constantly improving the quality of what we do. We do this for others, and we do it primarily in response to God's love for us. We want to be part of a movement that takes our commitments seriously. Now, if the thought of doing something with excellence is daunting to you, you may be thinking, well, you have to do something brilliant or extravagant. And if you compare, you know, your performance to others, what they've done, with achievements they've acquired or the achievements they've been able to accomplish, you might think, well, I can never do that. Listen, comparison or fear of failure, they can cripple your thoughts and paralyze your actions before you've ever begun. Too many times people think, well, what if my best isn't good enough? Well, don't be comparing yourself to others. Your job is to simply do your very best. These self-defeating thoughts, they can hinder you in the workplace as well as your home and any other area of your life. You know, you think, well, what happens if this meeting doesn't go well? What happens if, you know, in a work scenario, what happens if I don't meet my sales goals? What happens if I don't get the best performance rating? What if my church or charity doesn't meet the giving goals that we've set? You know, we usually know what our organization or company expects, but what does God expect? I believe God first expects excellence through obedience. Obedience. Just obedience. Your performance will never achieve perfection. Rather, God values the highest use of your talents and gifts to further his purposes. Apostle Paul talks about love in 1 Corinthians 13, but I always like the verse that he prefaces that, the love chapter with. 1 Corinthians 12:31, eagerly pursue the greater gifts, but he says this, but I will show you the most excellent way. And then he talks about love. So it's all done out of a motivation of love. Love for God, love for others. First Timothy chapter 3 and verse 13, Paul tells Timothy that those who serve well gain an excellent standing, he says to Timothy. In Titus chapter 3 and verse 8, Paul says that good works are excellent and profitable for everyone. Nebuchadnezzar, by the way, considered Daniel above his whole realm of all of his advisors and all of his people because he says in Daniel chapter 6 and verse 3 that there was an excellent spirit in Daniel. Let's look at that passage I referenced in Colossians chapter 3, Colossians 3, 23 and 24. Whatever you do, work at it with all your heart. And here's the key again, as working for the Lord, not for human masters, since you know that you will achieve an inheritance from the Lord as your reward. It is the Lord Christ you're serving. And by the way, there's another passage in Corinthians. Ron actually just sent it out in one of his Monday morning things. I forget the reference, but it says, know that nothing you do for the Lord is ever in vain. Everything you do for the Lord, none of it's in vain. So Paul says that we should work at whatever we work at with all of our heart. Don't be held back. You can achieve as much as I believe that you put your mind to. Don't let false expectations or unrealistic comparisons cripple your thoughts or paralyze your actions. Excellence comes as a result of how you purpose to achieve what has God called you using your gifts and talents that he's given you, whether it be in the church, the home, or the workplace. So I've been referencing church a lot. This applies in the home. This applies in the workplace, all of it. That passage we read earlier from Mark 7, Jesus obeyed the Father. He acted in the power of the Holy Spirit. People saw that he had done all things well. And by the way, he had just performed miracles such as restoring a man's hearing and speech. When you trust and obey God and serve under the power of the Holy Spirit, you will achieve excellence in all that you do, and you might even see a miracle or two along the way. So pray for opportunities to challenge yourself, to do something outside of your comfort zone. Practice that skill. If necessary, ask God, you know, to provide you with the ability to demonstrate excellence by doing all things well, knowing that you're doing them for the judge of one, the audience of one, doing them for the Lord, the King of all kings. You're not doing them for people. However, people will be blessed and inspired when you do so. And again, I just want to reemphasize that we're pursuing excellence, not perfectionism. I want to compare the two a little bit. Excellence, let's say it this way. When you are pursuing perfectionism, it leads to frustration, disappointment, and condemnation. Excellence is inspiring. So, perfectionism. Perfectionism is paralyzing. If we wait until we can do all things perfectly, we'll never do anything. We won't take any risk. We won't stretch our abilities, and we won't grow. In fact, arguing that we can't do something well enough is often the best way to avoid actually having to do anything. There's kind of a joke for husbands getting out of chores. It goes like this around the house. The best way to avoid lifting a finger is to prove that you're all thumbs. So you just, I can't do anything. You get out of it that way. So what's the motivation for perfectionism? It's fear. Perfectionism is motivated by fear. Fear of man, fear of failure. Perfectionism says, what will happen if I mess up? If someone will mess us up, then I'm going to crack the whip and be mad at him. By the way, actually, to some degree, Danny Silk's been talking about that whole thing a bit. Perfectionism. It's an unrealistic aim. Let's just face it. It's a target no one can hit. No one can be perfect at everything, but we all can be excellence. And perfectionism allows no room for mistakes. This conference is about great grace. There's no grace in perfectionism. You weren't perfect? That's not good enough. That's perfectionism. Even the slightest slip-up, that's not good enough. Well, on the other hand, excellence is, well, I didn't hit the mark I wanted to hit, but I'm going to do better next time, and there's grace for that. And perfectionism results in being easily discouraged, disappointment. Let's contrast that with excellence. Excellence, as I said just a minute ago, the motivation is love. Excellence says I'm serious about what I do, but I don't take my self too seriously. There's room for mistakes here. There's room for improvement. It's a healthy aim. God has given each of us a calling, and we're stewards of our calling. You know, whatever it is, musician, businessman, artist, teacher, pastor, ministry leader, serving the Lord with excellence is a healthy aim. And again, there's room for mistakes. There's grace. And when you pursue excellence with grace, it's not easily discouraged. Even if you haven't met your goals, if you haven't reached your full potential, excellence doesn't get discouraged. It looks at each, if you want to call them failures, each result that was less than we hoped for is simply an opportunity to grow and to do it better next time. So no matter what you do, I'd like to encourage you to do it with excellence. And if you apply the principle of excellence to your life, you'll find contentment in your work and continue to improve. Replacing perfectionism with excellence can bring freedom to your life and help you to become a better steward of the talents that God has given you. When you work with excellence, God will always help you to surpass your dreams. Now, I said we'd get into some practical things. We're finally going to get there. Number one, this is as it relates specifically to church, most of these things. Target, hire, or recruit as volunteers high energy, high capacity people. Now, in today's labor market, attracting talent can be very competitive and very difficult. However, never make the mistake of believing that a high capacity person, that person that you'd love to have serving in a certain role, that they would never agree to do so. Because when it comes to hiring or recruiting, we in the church have a significant advantage over many in the marketplace. Many people see the mission of the church as more compelling than a company who has a mission of manufacturing widgets or whatever it may be. And by the way, that's not to say that the secular marketplace is less important or less spiritual. That's not the point. If a person is called to the marketplace, their calling is honorable as that, as a pastor or a missionary. However, having said that, many believers will have a predisposition that a role in the church is a more compelling, change the world kind of calling. Unfortunately, we too often can lose that advantage if we run our churches in a slipshod or careless manner, or if we assume that person is way too busy, would never serve in the church, they make too much money on the job they're at, whatever the reasons are. Look for the high energy, high capacity people that you think would never accept the role. That's the first people you should be going for. When I started my role as executive pastor, I took a 75% pay cut to go from the role I was in to the role as a pastor. Anybody looking from the outside, and I owned a real estate company, anybody looking from the outside would say, he's never going to leave his real estate company to go be a pastor over the church for 25% of what he's making now. I did. And so never assume that people won't make those kinds of decisions. Never say people's no for them. Number two, facilities must be kept clean and uncluttered. I hit this a couple times already. Facilities don't have to be fancy or expensive, but they must be clean, well-kept, and uncluttered. Here's number three. This is one of my pet peeves. Phone calls and emails must be returned promptly and professionally. When I first left the business world and got into ministry, I was shocked at how people in ministry were incompetent at returning phone calls and emails. It was pathetic. If I'd have done that in the business world, I'd have got run out on a rail. But somehow, they got away with it in the church world. Promptly, I think, means the same day to me. A simple, thanks for the message. I'll check on that and get back to you tomorrow. That's acceptable. That's courteous. It doesn't mean you have to have the answer for them, but a very simple text back to returning a text or an email or whatever. Hey, thanks for the email. Hey, thanks for the text. I'll get back to you in a day or two on that. That's great. You've responded. They now know that you care about what they sent to you. Number four, media presentations must be done with excellence. Every video we plan to play in a service has to be preloaded, pre-tested, played, and believed to be likely to run flawlessly. Can't be guaranteed, but believe that it'll be run flawlessly. Sermon notes or song lyrics should be modern looking, again, preloaded and tested to ensure functionality. I was in a couple of services recently in different settings where the fonts on the screen, they look like they were from 1942. I'm like, where did you find these fonts? I don't even think that they even exist anymore. Use modern looking stuff. Number six is good long-term planning. If you're going to be a multi-church staff, you need to do more long-term planning than you may have been used to when you're smaller. However, even if you're a small organization, it's important that everyone in your organization knows the vision and where you are headed. Sometimes when a church just has a one-person staff, people feel like they can be spontaneous and change on the fly. But when you operate that way, you'll give volunteers and others whiplash with that approach. So do some long-term planning, then stick to the plan. Every year, our leadership team gets together in October, and we plan the church calendar for the next year. Schedule things out: baby dedication, communion, family day, retreats, young adult day, you know, Sunday, youth Sunday, so on and so forth. But beyond that, I have a service planning spreadsheet. We plan out things like the sermon series and who will be preaching months in advance. I think this provides a sense of security to the church staff and the volunteers. They know what's coming. They know how to plan. And by the way, just a note on sermon series, we found them to be extremely effective. The congregation loves them and engages with them really well. It helps the pastor, me, because I remember many times I'd sit down on a Monday morning or Tuesday morning. I'm like, what am I going to preach about on Sunday? Sometimes the hardest thing is just trying to figure out what your topic is. What are you going to preach about? After you get that figured out, putting it together sometimes isn't as hard as just trying to figure out what it's going to be. What sermon series has that all laid out in advance? And again, we found that to be really good. The other thing about sermon series is you can then do small group discussion guides that come alongside the sermon, have that all prepared ahead of time, and then the small groups are discussing what was preached on Sunday, and that has really worked well for us, and it's a great way to assist our small group leaders and help our small group ministry to be more effective. Number seven is clear policy and procedure. Now, when one starts talking policy and procedure, here's where it's easy to lose people, because very few ministry leaders are really passionate about policy and procedure. Do I hear an amen? The reality is that if you don't pay attention to these kind of details, they will turn around and bite you really bad sometimes. Sometimes people think, well, we all love Jesus. You know, we all love each other. You know, we don't need all that stuff. Listen, let me assure you that policies and established procedure will keep you loving each other. Many times, sour relationships or bad fallings out are a result of unmet expectations or poor communication. If I had to pick two things, it's unmet expectations and poor communication. Those are the two big things that result in fallings out. If expectations are clear and in writing, if communication is direct and straightforward, you can avoid a world of hurt and fractured relationships. This is so important because I stated earlier, many times, people are serving the church because of their great passion for the mission. And as I said, they're willing to do so many times at great sacrifice to their own personal freedom or their own personal financial gain. So when there's a misunderstanding or when there's unmet expectations, they will suddenly feel defrauded and they will react in a way that seems disproportional to the slight or the slip up because they were so invested in this. I sacrificed. I could have been doing this. I could be doing that. But I sacrificed to serve here because I believe in the mission. I believe in the vision of this church. And now I get treated like this. And so the reaction is disproportional to the offense because of the level of commitment, buy-in, and sacrifice that they have given to serve the church. Here's number 8, raise up and empower younger leaders. This is so important. I'm always looking for quality young people in our church. I'm looking to identify and affirm and call out positive character traits and giftings in the church. Chris Tangert, he's an associate pastor at Westgate. In fact, he's here at this conference. I noticed him in youth group and as a young adult at our church. He always seemed like a real high-quality man of integrity and moral character. And when he graduated from high school, he took a job with a local auction company. Later, he decided that the auction business wasn't for him, and he left. And I remember when he left that job, I made the statement to someone. I was talking to someone about it. I said, man, I wish I had a job opening right now in business. I had moved into ministry. I didn't have a business to hire him into. But boy, if I did, I'd hire him right now. I'd figure out what job later. I'd train him for it. But there's a quality young man. Well, wouldn't you know, about 3, 4, 5 years later, we had an opening for an associate pastor at the church. In the meanwhile, Chris had taken a job as a sales and account management representative at a local HVAC company. So we had this opening, and I put out, cast a wide net, seeking applicants for that job. And the Dove Leadership Training School graduates all got reached out to. The Hopewell Network, Dove International, Harvest Net, all these local church networks. You know, we have this opening. I received about 12 or 14 applications. Chris Tangert didn't apply. And so I arranged a meeting with Chris and Hope Tangert, and I asked them to pray about applying for the job. And I said to him, listen, I'm not offering you a job, but I am asking you to consider and pray about applying for the job. Okay, here's the catch. Chris was only in his early 20s, and he didn't have any ministry experience. I'll never forget the email I received about 2 weeks later. I got an email. The subject line was peace to apply, and he wanted to say that he does have peace to apply for that role. Ultimately, I and the elders team, we went through a long process of narrowing down the applicants to a few, and we put Chris and Hope through various assessments and profiles. And at the end of the day, we asked Chris to join our staff as an associate pastor. And Chris has been an awesome addition to our team. Here's the thing. Had I not reached out to him, he would have never applied. He didn't see himself qualified for the role. Here's the dirty little secret. He wasn't qualified for the role. And I knew it, and he knew it. But I knew that he was a man of character and integrity, and I saw God's anointing on his life. And I asked him to go ahead and apply. And now he's just been an awesome addition to our staff. It's one of the best things we ever did. Here's the thing. God doesn't always call the qualified. Many times he qualifies the called. So look for those young people that are called. They may not be qualified, but we can get them qualified. Josh Good was originally in consideration for the associate pastor job that went to Chris Tangert. He ultimately didn't take that job, and of course it went to Chris. But later, some years later, we were having a WSA brainstorming meeting. We were talking about the need for a WSA youth leader. And Josh was just graduating from college with his master's degree. And he was not interested in our position when I reached out to him. He had several other offers around the country that seemed much more intriguing to him. However, I put it before him. I said, well, here's the deal, Josh. We believe that you could come on as a Dove Westgate youth director and as a WSA youth director, part-time, 50-50 each role, and I believe that God might be calling you that. Pray about it. Well, ultimately, Josh came on in that role, 50-50, when he didn't, in his flesh, that's not what he wanted to do. He felt like he had all these great offers in Charlotte, North Carolina, wherever it was, all around the country, that seemed so much more appealing than staying in Lancaster County, Pennsylvania. But he ended up accepting that role and was a great addition to our staff and ultimately served as a great addition to WSA Youth and ultimately on the WSA Apostolic Team, again, all because we went after a young man that we saw as gifted and talented. Ellis Martin, he's our current youth director at Westgate. We hired Ellis when we didn't even need him. Why do we do that? Because a son of the house who had just graduated from college was willing to take a pass on a great job offer in finance, which was his degree, so he could take a part-time ministry role at his home church and then just work some other part-time job, whatever he could get. And so I said, well, listen, if he's willing to do that, he's a son of the house, he's a quality young man, we're going to hire him even though we didn't really need him. What we didn't know at the time, none of us knew, including Josh, is that within 3 to 4 months, Josh would be announcing his resignation to do a business startup. And so, lo and behold, when Josh stepped down, we already had our new youth director in place already because we assertively went after a quality young man of the house, a son of the house, and were willing to bring him on at a role that we didn't even really need him for because we had a son of the house we didn't want to let get away. And so look for those people. Do what you have to bring them on. Number 9 is model servanthood when leading your staff. Set up and tear down chairs. Pick up trash. When you're walking through the building, if there's trash on the floor, you should be the one picking it up. Be willing to do small jobs that are below your pay grade. I cook a meal every other year. We do a rite of passage for our like junior hires a rite of passage into adulthood kind of thing. I cook the meal for that ceremony on Friday night. I cook breakfast for our men's retreat. Just these sorts of small ways to model servanthood. If you're willing to serve in these ways, you will create loyalty and respect with your staff and volunteers and with the congregation, and you will create an ethos and a value system that you want and need in your organization. Some of you are saying, yeah, I do that all the time. In fact, I'm the only guy that takes out trash. Well, keep serving, but raise up some young person that can help you with that. All right, number 10, elder board dynamics. I need to move quickly on this one, but just say that elder boards, I believe, that need to move from being a decision maker, working through every minute detail of how the church functions into being a policy governance board. Well, what does that mean? Well, for most churches, it means that the elders should not be the place to decide what the date should be for the next prayer meeting or whether a certain person is qualified to be a Sunday school teacher or if they should authorize the purchase of a new desk chair for the associate pastor. Elder boards should approve budgets, set policy, drive vision. They should not micromanage individual decisions, because when you do, your elders' meetings will go till midnight, and no one will find it very life-giving. So we made that transition from a number of years back, and the initial transition can be hard because elders' teams become accustomed to being consulted about and approving each and every decision in the church. But we need to, I think, for elders to function most effectively, move beyond the minutia of the day-to-day decisions, not get bogged down in that stuff, because when they do, they won't have the energy or the time to look at the big picture issues and stay and keep the church with a forward-looking vision and momentum that's so critical. Secondly, when the elders' teams do make all those decisions, the staff and volunteers can feel very micromanaged and disempowered to do their jobs. Here's number 11, pay attention to the church finances. If you're a senior leader, I am very much surprised by how many lead elders know very, very little about the church finances. This is a primary issue by which, as a church leader, you can gain or lose credibility with church attendees. The lead elder or the senior pastor doesn't need to pay the bills or do the accounting, but they need to be intimately involved with the details. They need to know what's going on. They need to monitor the progress and direction. So budget carefully with significant detail. Insist that the budget be adhered to, which means some fights every now and then, some arm wrestling. But by the way, the senior pastor doesn't have to do that, but someone has to. It can be the senior pastor, it can be another person, but then the lead pastor, the lead elder, needs to stand behind and support the person that's holding people's feet to the fire on the budget. But the budget must be adhered to. And when you do that, I've found over the years that we have, as a church, gained, our people have tremendous confidence in our handling the finances. We have tremendous credibility with the congregation as a leadership team on how we handle the finances, because they know we have a budget, we will stick to it, and the finances will be conducted and in a manner of integrity and with clear, solid business principles engaged. Other leadership issues, and I don't really have time to get into these to any detail at all, but we need to grow in our ability to manage and hopefully avoid conflict on our leadership teams. There's actually a lot of good books to be read on that, but it's an important part of our leadership is being able to manage conflict. You like to avoid it, but you're not going to avoid it altogether. We do need to learn how to manage it. I feel like we really need to be knowing how to inspire confidence in those that we lead. And one of the ways we do that is by doing our work with excellence. The other way we do that is by our punctuality, certainly, as I said, with returning phone calls and emails and texts and those sorts of things. Just a quick note on time management. One of my favorite sayings on that is sometimes people complain that I'm just so busy, I just don't have time for this, just don't have time. Well, there's only one person in the world that control your schedule, and that's you. So if your schedule's too full, then you're the one that can deal with that, and no one else can deal with that. So you're responsible to maintain your schedule in such a way that it's maintainable, that it's sustainable. And again, leading, I talked about this before, but leading with integrity, diligence, always take the high road, take ownership for issues that you don't even think really are yours. By the way, here's one thing that I've found over the years. When you say, I'm sorry, that was my fault, I need to take responsibility for that, even if it's questionable whether it really was your fault or your responsibility, still, if you're the leader, it ultimately comes down to you. And when you do that, sometimes people get the idea, they think, well, if I say, hey, that's my fault, I should have done better, then people are going to look down on me because, you know, they think, well, they should have done a better job. My experience has been when you take ownership for things, that actually raises your credibility. You say, I should have done better. I could have done a better job with that. I missed that detail. I'm sorry about that. That raises your credibility. It doesn't lower your credibility. So always look for a way to do that. That's part of leading with integrity, taking the high road. Always be interested in personal development. I learned that in the real estate world. I would take classes, courses all the time on sales, on finance, on whatever it is. And I still do the same thing in the ministry world. I'll see courses, seminars, classes on things, read books on things. Always, always be working on growing as a person, growing as a leader, and doing things. And congratulations for being here and being in this workshop, because you probably do care about personal development or you wouldn't be here. So keep up the good work on that. Many of these things, they're not all that hard to do. They simply require an attention to detail and an attitude that would portray that little things matter. All right, we've got 58 seconds for questions. Does anybody have any? And we can go. I can go on past 3 o'clock. I don't really care. Do you have any questions, Amanda?
We were talking, actually, two questions. When you were talking about elder board dynamics,
yeah,
and kind of getting into the higher level stuff, like approving budgets, setting policies, there was also a third thing. Approving budgets, set policies.
Elder board dynamics, setting policies, approving budgets, and creating vision for forward momentum, casting vision, long-term planning, casting vision for the future.
And the other question was, you had mentioned visiting a church when you were on vacation.
Yes.
And wandering on the lobby. Did you ever get an opportunity to give feedback to that church?
No. The question is, when I was visiting the church that did not engage me as a guest, did I ever give it feedback to that pastor, to that church? I did not. I perhaps could have, but I didn't. And the person that was the senior pastor there then is no longer the senior pastor there. The current senior pastor I see and pray with on almost a weekly basis, but I've never spilled the beans about that visit. Maybe if they'd asked me for a suggestion on how they can do church better, I'll get that opportunity someday, but I just didn't get into it. Yeah. Any other questions? And again, if you have to leave, feel free. But any other questions?
Darrell, I would be very interested in shifting the eldership board dynamics. Perhaps for next year, would you consider that? Perhaps a teaching on that?
Shifting the elder board dynamics.
Because especially the smaller churches, we run everything through the eldership.
Understood.
It's like,
yeah.
It can train people. people, especially those who are motivated to get things done, and you know, the meetings get dragged out. So I would be very interested in that, your teaching on it.
Okay, we can connect on that. Yeah. Yeah, it's good. Thank you, Nigel. The question for the recording was just about more direction and insight on how to do the transition to an elders board that is policy governance as opposed to hands-on running the minutiae of the church. And that's something we could pick up at another time.
Just off-the-cuff question. I know you practice your messages. Do you use PowerPoints beyond just putting scripture up? Do you like the cutesy PowerPoint thing?
Questions about PowerPoints for messages. So for years, I did my own PowerPoints for my messages. And we hired a full-time media director, which was quite a luxury for me. I really appreciate having a full-time media director. So now all I do is I take a printed version of my message, and I take a yellow highlighter, and I highlight the things that I want put on PowerPoints on the screens. And so she creates whatever she creates. And so I don't even have any input into that anymore. So I did do his, in the question he asked, do you do, you know, cutesy PowerPoint things? I used to find it amusing to do things where they came flying in from one side, then the other, then up from the bottom, or spin as they come in. And yeah, I did some of that. And that seems to have fallen out of favor. And so we don't do that anymore. But she does create all the PowerPoints. So whatever she creates. And I don't really pay much attention to it because I'm not looking at that. I'm staying focused on what I'm doing. Good. Hey, thank you all for your attention, for being here. Blessings. Lead with excellence.